My guest today, Andrew Coburn, is part of the great, is part of the most distinguished family in Western journalism, being one of three sons of the great radical British journalist Claude Coburn, all of whom became distinguished journalists in their own right. His brothers Patrick and my late friend Alexander have been my guests on Takes on the World, as been Andrew, discussing the last of his many books, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, which came out in 2015, and dealt with another of President Obama's legacies, The Rise of Drone Warfare as America's New Weapon of Choice. In the current issue of Harper's, where he serves as the magazine's Washington editor, Andrew adds another major crime to the president's charge sheet in an article entitled Acceptable Losses, Aiding and Abetting the Saudi Slaughter in Yemen. Welcome, Andrew Coburn, to Takes on the World.
Hey there. Good to be with you.
In your article in Harper's, you quote the head of the International Red Cross as declaring that, quote, Yemen after 5 months looks like Syria after 5 years. Why hasn't the U.S. public heard as much about our allies, the Saudis, what they're doing there with U.S. support, as we have about the carnage in Syria?
I think it's basically because we are really enabling this war to an even greater extent than we are in Syria. I mean, we could talk about that another time. Our participation in the Syrian war is sort of semi-covert, whereas in Yemen, you know, we are arming the Saudis, providing the targeting information. We, you know, when they run low on ammunition, we send them more. We give them diplomatic support. I mean, this is our war. And so I think, you know, the opinion formers, the official, you know, officially approved opinion formers will find it a bit awkward to explain all that. So they ignore it.
The media never asked him questions about it.
No, I mean occasionally when the Saudis blow up another hospital, he gets a little coverage. But really, considering you know the enormity of this war, the way it's basically destroyed a country which was already you know very impoverished. For reasons that really have absolutely zero to do with U.S. national security, I think it's just completely appalling.
Well, you know, Yemen has long been one of the poorest countries in the world before the war, ironically, next to one of the world's richest. How is this... how poor is Yemen, was Yemen, and how poor is it now?
Well, I give some figures at the start of the piece. You know, it was like out of 170-odd countries on the Human Development Index, you know, Yemen was 140. 40,000 children a year died before they reached their fifth birthday, and so on down the line. It has severe water crisis. You know, this is no disrespect on the Yemenis, who themselves are a very, you know, sort of spirited and hardworking and totally terrific people. So it was already in a dire state, and you know, they needed a lot of aid and help. And that was before we and the Saudis. You know, I want to stress again, this is our war with the Saudis. You know, flew hundreds of thousands of bombing missions. Destroying infrastructure, economic targets, water bottling plants, port facilities, hospitals, schools, museums. You know that. You know it's like talk about kicking someone when they're down. I mean, this is really what's been going on in Yemen for the last year and a half.
Well, I know Doctors Without Borders complained, whose hospitals, at least three of their hospitals, were hit, that they had gave the Saudis the coordinates. So exactly, the Saudis knew exactly, the pilots knew exactly where the hospitals were and that they were targeted.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders have now pulled out of northern Yemen. They just say, you know, we can't go on like this. The Saudis, looks like the Saudis, you know, one hospital may be an accident, maybe, even though, you know, from the beginning, the group, which was very experienced in this, was you know giving all the coordinates to the Saudi Arabians. In fact, interestingly enough, I happen to know that when the Médecins Sans Frontières teams were like going to an area to give, you know, medical assistance, they would call. They had a number in Saudi Arabia to call to avoid, you know, which they were told would enable, give them some protection. The person who answered the other end was an American. So, you know, this is very much, you know, yet another reminder, this is a Saudi-American operation. But they, okay, so one hospital, you could say, well, accidents will happen. Two hospitals, three, four. I think they've hit five or, you know, they've hit at least four Doctors Without Borders facilities so far. So, you know, it's clear this is, you know, which is very definitely a war crime.
And you point out in the article that what the Saudis really seem to be targeting is as many places where civilians congregate, markets, streets, at the time when the streets are crowded.
That's right. I mean, they, you know, there have been, I mean, really massacres. You know, there was one earlier this year where they hit a marketplace, killed 106 people. They've hit wedding parties several times. You know, or even slightly down the scale. At one point, they decided to, someone on the Saudi side had the bright idea of hitting all the gas stations in Sada, which is a northern city. So they went around and sort of, you know, bombed all the gas stations, and because of severe gas shortages, people line up in their cars for hours, sometimes days, waiting for, you know, to get fuel. So there were, you know, large numbers of people were incinerated in their cars just because they were waiting for gas at the gas station. Some moral idiot on the other side decided, you know, the gas station was a suitable target.
And this country, Yemen, relies on imports, and the Saudis have a blockade assisted by the U.S. Navy.
Well, that's right. That's the other thing we hear even less about, which is the whole blockade of, you know, sort of in the most literal sense, you know, ships stopping ships from entering port, which has been going on. The U.S. Navy sort of backs up, you know, allegedly looking for Iranian weapon supplies going to the other side. I mean, the Iranians, you know, that's part of the excuse for this whole war, that Iran was establishing a beachhead on Saudi Arabia's southern border, and, you know, the U.S. agrees that's a threat. In fact, we know from internal, you know, WikiLeaks cables that the actual U.S. diplomats on the scene thought that was all, you know, there was no real basis to that, but we've gone along with it. I mean, the Iranians have given some assistance to the Houthis, who are the principal component of, you know, fighting against the Saudis, in the form of cash. They've given them money, and they've given them some, you know, I think some specialized communications gear, so far as I know. But, you know, big weapon, this, all this question about issue of big weapon supplies, I believe, is a myth.
Well, in your article, you provide some background information on the Houthis that you won't find in the mainstream media. Perhaps you could tell us about who are the Houthis, where do they get their name, where do they come from, and what part of the Shia religion do they relate to?
Well, to answer the last part first, I mean, they're sort of very much, you know, their relationship, connection to mainstream Shiism, you know, as practiced in Iraq and Iran, is pretty marginal. In fact, until recently, the Iranians, you know, they considered the people in Yemen, who are called Zaydis, this sect, the Zaydi sect, kind of a heresy. They, you know, didn't consider themselves connected at all. But it is, you know, there is a relationship with this dissident brand of Islam, with the Shia brand, if you like. This is the Zaydis, so-called. They have for centuries lived in North Yemen, in the mountains, and up towards what is now, you know, what is the Saudi border. And part of the ones in one area, it wasn't all of them, in one area, they'd sort of, was on the ones along the border, and in the district, the Sada district, for years they were, it was a pretty poor part of Yemen. They lived mostly by smuggling into Saudi Arabia, and basically, you know, weren't much bother to anyone. But Saudis, they have this, you know, long-standing policy. They get rid of their own, you know, sort of dissidents, I mean, you know, extremist, fundamentalist dissidents, by exporting them and sending them off to make trouble somewhere else. So in 1979-1980, they did that with someone who just actually tried to mount a violent overthrow of the Saudi government. So they packed him off. Instead of chopping his head off, which they did to some of his colleagues, they sent him off to this district in North Yemen with instructions to start a Wahhabi sort of center, a fundamentalist sort of education center, which would be, you know, which it was like an outpost in the middle of what they regarded as a sort of, you know, as a, they didn't like the Zaydis because they had a different brand of religion and weren't under their total control. So they, the guy went and did this, and this produced a reaction. The local Zaydis said, well, what's going on here? And maybe we should think more seriously about our religion. And because they had nowhere else to turn, they made a connection, communicated with the Iranians, and got, you know, basically textbooks and some teachers. It wasn't more than that. There was no sort of military involvement. But this gradually escalated, and the, I'm sorry if this all gets a bit complicated, but the ruler of Yemen at that time said, realized he could get money out of the Saudis if he said, oh, I'm going to combat these wicked heretics who are linked with the Iranians, and started a series of wars which led to the militarization of those people in the north. They became a formidable fighting force and called themselves the Houthis after their leader, who the original leader, who was killed. It's his brother who's in charge now. So that's the sort of background of the Houthis. And when there was a sort of national uprising in Yemen in 2011, you know, against dictatorship and corruption, the Houthis are very much part of that. And basically, you know, fast-forwarding, they, because they considered they were being dealt out of the settlement following that, they took over, first of all, the capital, Sana'a, in 2014, and then actually, you know, which freaked the Saudis out. So the Saudis started bombing in March 2015, March 26th. And, you know, as usual with bombing campaigns, it didn't actually do them militarily much good. In fact, from then on, the Houthis went on to take over large chunks of the country. And, the fighting's gone on ever since.
You know, it's interesting, the U.S.-Saudi relationship, which is much on the table these days, particularly with the efforts of Congress passing a law to allow American survivors of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia because of its alleged involvement or support of the alleged hijackers, which the president said he'll veto on the basis that if they could sue the Saudis, there are a lot of people around the world could bring charges against the United States, much greater charges, in fact, that anything could be brought against Saudi Arabia, because compared to what the United States has done in other parts of the world, with all due respect to the survivors and what happened in 9/11, it's not comparable, not comparable at all. And but there doesn't seem to be any recognition, not just among Congress, but among the American people, for what we have done around the world. So I would suggest that probably most Americans are all for suing the Saudis, because Americans really don't take responsibility, own up to what this country has done to destabilize the entire region of the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, I have no argument there. But, I mean, there's more of, you know, what they can do. And actually, there are, you know, dissent is growing in Congress. I mean, 60 congressmen voted the other day to cut off arms supplies to Saudi Arabia. Now, that's a more practical proposition. There was a close vote earlier in the year to at least ban cluster bomb sales to Saudi Arabia. I mean, basically, using cluster bombs is a war crime. A lot of countries, I think, are now at over 100 countries in the world, 108 countries, I think, have signed on to an agreement, you know, not to use cluster bombs because they pose unacceptable harm to civilians. Two of the exceptions being Saudi Arabia and the United States. So we've gone on selling them cluster bombs. The U.S.-Saudi relationship is showing signs of strain. But, you know, as I say in the article, as I explain, you know, I thought it was really worth explaining to people just how deep it is in terms of just the military relationship. I mean, we've sold now, since the start of the Obama administration, we've sold the Saudis $115 billion. That's a lot of money. $115 billion worth of weapons. I mean, most of them haven't been delivered yet, but they're in the pipeline. The Saudis, and as I discovered and point out in the article, when the Saudis buy these weapons, there's a markup, which goes straight to the department. Goes straight to the Department of Defense, which it uses for activities in other parts of the world. As someone who'd been in charge of this system told me, he said, "Well, it's great," he said, "because the Saudis, they pay for things that are very useful for us, like our military mission in Bolivia." He said, "That's really paid for by the Saudis because the Bolivians can't afford it." And so there's this whole income stream that comes into the Pentagon from Saudi Arabia that, never goes near Congress, which I thought was pretty interesting. Saudi Arabia in other ways, too. Saudi Arabia, to get to our big bases in the big American bases in the Gulf, in Qatar and Bahrain, you could avoid it, but it's kind of difficult. Basically, the easiest way to get there is to fly over Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis, they make it clear they control that airspace, and they make the Americans ask permission when they want to fly over Saudi Arabia. And every so often they say, "No, you can't." So, it's very key to the whole system of imperial control that we stay on good terms with the Saudis. I mean, there are so many, we get the Saudis to pay when we're doing something, having one of our covert or semi-covert wars around the place. We get the Saudis to pay for it, like in Syria. That's a joint U.S.-Saudi operation supporting effectively supporting al-Qaeda in Syria. I mean, earlier, this goes in the 1980s, there was a U.S.-Saudi operation against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And also in the 1980s, the Saudis paid for the Contra terrorists we were sending into Nicaragua. So this is such a deep and pervasive relationship, far more so than most people realize.
Well, I always had the impression that the Saudis have always been the major purchasers of U.S. weaponry, but didn't use it. This is a new generation of Saudis that have actually begun to use the weaponry, as we saw first when they intervened in Bahrain. But they have this new young Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's decided to flex his muscles, or the muscles of those people he pays. He's not going to do his own fighting, of course.
Well, he was stupid enough to believe all the sales talk from the Americans. Yeah, that's right. In fact, the excuse used to be for us sending the sending all these weapons to Saudi Arabia. It was known in the Pentagon as the Saudi overbuild, and what that meant was that the Saudis paid us billions of dollars to buy all these airplanes and everything, and they'd sit there in Saudi Arabia, and if there was a crisis and we needed to go to war somewhere in the region, we could just sort of get all the pilots and people, put them on a passenger plane, fly them to Saudi Arabia, and all the equipment would be sitting there. And so it was kind of a presumption that the Saudis wouldn't really use it. But as you say, now we've got this young prince who's in charge, and I think he believed what the salesman said, because he sounds like a bit of an idiot, basically, that, with all this precision bombing capability that we're selling you, you can put the Houthis out of action in a matter of days and get what you want, which, of course, as usual with bombing campaigns, has turned out not to be the case.
It's interesting that, of course, the weapons manufacturers, particularly aircraft manufacturers, have long depended on the Saudis to keep their employment lines going, their manufacturing lines going. I remember during 1991, after the Saudis paid for that U.S. intervention in Kuwait, that they told President Bush at the time that they could not afford to buy the last round they had ordered of jets of McDonnell Douglas, which would have forced the plant to close. And Bush said, "You can't do that. we'll make a payment plan that will enable you to pay us and keep the plant going. And it was a small item in the San Francisco Chronicle that when the Saudis had agreed to that deal, it was announced in St. Louis, and the McDonnell Douglas employees partied all night.
Right. Well, that's right. You know, it's very important. I mean, currently, that's the same thing's going on now. The, you know, with this huge F-15 order, you know, yet another one. I mean, it was an earlier one you're talking about. But in 2010, they agreed to buy, you know, a further fleet of F-15s, especially, you know, $30 billion worth. And that's keeping that production line open. That's 7,000 jobs in St. Louis and probably another 30,000 around the rest of the country. So no wonder, you know, they get attention. I think it's very, you know, I'm all for, obviously want people to have jobs, but when you've got huge, you know, large sections of the workforce dependent on, you know, orders from some bunch of war criminals, you know, who are using it to destroy a country somewhere else, it gets kind of morally questionable, I'd say.
My guest is Andrew Coburn. We're talking to him about Yemen. What's interesting, you have so many members of Congress wringing their hands about the genuine tragedy, the carnage in Syria. But so few have spoken about Yemen. Although, as you say, now there is more of a demand to halt the weapons, but not to really investigate what's been going on there. You do quote one congressman from California who I was not familiar with named Ted Lieu.
Yeah, he's a good man.
Is he from Southern California?
Yeah. It's from the Los Angeles area. Yeah.
Who has questioned this, but it's interesting, these crocodile tears that so many members of Congress shed for the people of Syria who they really don't care about at all.
Right.
And now we have the prospect of a Hillary Clinton presidency putting in a no-fly zone there. And, of course, she and her husband, I forget his name, Bill, something like that. Anyway, they have this foundation, and the Saudis have given them a lot of money.
You know. Yeah. It's at least $10 million.
$10 million,
it's made. $10 million or more, yeah.
And Bill has said, if she's president, we won't take any more money from them. Well, they just give it directly to the arms manufacturers instead.
Exactly. So, I mean, no, it's completely outrageous, you know. This is a regime that chops off the heads of gay people. It's, you know, oppresses women. It's basically a very cruel slave economy.
Well, you mentioned the Wahhabi, Wahhabi sect, which is what the Saudi essentially are. Also, Al-Qaeda and ISIS are also Wahhabists. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that and the connection. You've said that how Saudis export their would-be terrorists and their strange relationship with Al-Qaeda, even in Yemen as well. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the Saudi, well, the sort of one data point you can point to is when ISIS, you know, suddenly took over, you know, all those cities in Iraq and Syria, and they set up their own education system. The textbooks they, you know, forced all the schools to use were the official Saudi textbooks. You know, it's a striking point. Yeah, I mean, basically, Al-Qaeda, since the beginning, you know, well, let's go back to the Afghan War of the 1980s. There was a definite policy blessed by the United States, and in fact, participated in by the United States, which was to use the Afghan War as a vent. You know, they realized they had in all these countries, you know, including Yemen and Algeria and all the Arab states, that they had some troublesome people on their hands who might make trouble at home, who were sort of, you know, jihadis. So what better than to send them off to Afghanistan to, you know, fight the Soviet, kill a few Russians. They like the idea of that, and hopefully get killed themselves so they wouldn't come back home and, you know, make trouble. Well, it didn't work, as we know. And in fact, that's what that was the core. That's what became Al Qaeda, who you know came back with a vengeance in on 9/11. So, but that was still the Saudi policy. I mean, it's been the Saudi policy in Syria, encouraging you know disaffected or you know young men to go off and fight in Syria. And so, you know, this what I was describing earlier as their way of, you know, the trouble they caused in Yemen was the same policy. It's so, it's you know, it's the Saudi way of dealing with their, you know, they you know, the Saudi ruling regime. It's their way of sort of trying to avoid trouble at home, and that's what they do.
Well, it's interesting also that this is kind of. The recent developments, particularly in Syria, have lifted the veil over what has been a relationship, obviously, for a long time between the Saudis and the Israelis. And Qatar, all these Gulf countries are seen to be in bed with Israel, and Israel's talking about a new relationship because Iran is the major enemy. As a matter of fact, the Israelis say Iran is the bigger problem, not ISIS, which is interesting. They say that publicly, not just privately.
Oh, right. In fact, they've said that ISIS, really, there's been statements coming out of Israel, Israeli think tanks and everything, saying actually ISIS may be not so bad because it sort of, you know, causes trouble for the Iranians and Hezbollah and, you know, keeps all these Arab, you know, keeps Syria and Iraq in a state of turmoil. So, you know, I'll tell you a little story which illustrates the real relationship. Back in the late 1970s, there was the Saudis said they wanted to buy, you know, the first lot of F-15s, fighter planes. But the Israelis kicked up a fuss. They said, oh, these F-15s with the special long-range fuel tanks will be able to come and bomb Tel Aviv. And there was a huge row over that. And there was an agreement eventually that the Saudi F-15s would not have those long-range fuel tanks.
I remember that.
And the Israelis were, you know, promised given even more money and, you know, in aid to sort of mollify them as well. About a year or so later, when everyone had forgotten about this, the ban on the long-range fuel tanks to Saudi Arabia was quietly dropped. And the Israeli aircraft industry, the major aerospace firm in Israel, got the contract to make the long-range fuel tanks for the Saudis. So that's, you know, that's the real relationship. That, you know, the Israelis know the Saudis never were, never will be a threat to them, and the Saudis, are happy to have it's becoming more overt, but certainly a relationship, friendly relationship with Israel.
Well, a number of Palestinians, it took them a long time to learn that the Saudis were never their allies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about this bunch of, you know, sort of rapacious, this family, this clan, which had taken over Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia didn't have to be this way, but in order to maintain the Saudi family, I mean, they named the country after themselves. It's the Saudi ruling family. They, they can go on, you know, accumulating money and whatever else diversions they want. You know, they make this alliance with the Wahhabi establishment, and they, you know, basically just do anything to keep control.
And they also spend a lot of money buying hotels and stores in places like London. Like Harrods. it's an amazing story, and it's like two countries, two U.S. allies, Israel and the United States, Israel and the Saudis, have two different kind of special relationships, but they're really both kind of untouchable. It's actually today we see the Israelis are about to get the biggest prize in U.S. history in terms of weaponry, $38 billion over 10 years.
Yeah.
And $8 billion a year, $800 million a year raise. And that's a starting point. That's a minimum. And yet, Senator Lindsey Graham is going to hold us up because it isn't enough, he says. This is a senator from South Carolina. It's not enough. They need more. And also, for the first time this year, because the Israeli weapons industry has become a competitor with the United States, President Obama has demanded and put in this that instead of giving 25% of the money to Israel for its own weapons industry, all the $3.8 billion has to be spent in the United States. And Lindsey Graham says, no, we should have, they should get the 25% in Israel, which means less U.S. jobs. It's interesting how these people bow and scrape for Israel. And I don't believe, I didn't hear NPR, maybe NPR reported today on this deal, but usually the U.S. media plays down the deals, the financial arms deals between Israel and the United States. I don't know if it was reported back in the papers this morning there.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't hold your breath, I'd say.
You know, looking at the relationship between the United States and the in terms of Syria and in terms of Yemen, we now have a peace agreement, not a peace agreement, but a truce, a ceasefire between Syria and, with Russia and the United States have negotiated a ceasefire agreement, which seems to be holding. But this also is against Syrian and Israeli interest. What is your take on that?
Well, there's been, it's interesting, that's why there's so much sort of opposition to this ceasefire agreement that Kerry negotiated. Actually quite an interesting piece of the New York Times today, basically relaying the Pentagon point of view. I mean, the New York Times acting as basically a spokesman for the Pentagon, saying, "Oh, this is really a bad deal, and you can't trust the Russians." And you know, they don't mention that. You know, who? That's basically saying we should go on. You know, this is a bad deal for Al Qaeda, which is what the armed Syrian opposition basically consists of these days, largely. So it's a. I think for once, I mean, John Kerry's trying, I don't normally have good words to say for John Kerry, but he's, I applaud this. And it's interesting how much opposition it's raising from everyone from Al-Qaeda to Israel to...
NPR.
To NPR,
This morning, Steve Inskeep had a long interview with Kerry, and it was a hostile interview.
Really?
He usually, NPR... In all the years I've been listening to it, because I'm kind of addicted to listening to it, but forced to listen to it.
God, you're a glutton for punishment.
I am, actually. And it's always been ready to broadcast and have on the air U.S. government officials, State Department officials, generals, and so on, when the U.S. is planning some major intervention or to justify some intervention, U.S. policy. You never hear a critic. But today was the first time that I ever heard someone on NPR do a hostile interview with the Secretary of State, which he did with Kerry this morning. Kerry had to defend this deal. And as you say, the alternative is al-Nusra, which keeps changing its name, but we know what it is. And Inskeep was trying to tell him he was criticizing Kerry for demanding that the moderate rebels, whoever they are, separate themselves from al-Nusra, al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And Inskeep was defending their relationship. He kept pushing Kerry on this.
Oh, really?
Well, the rebels will have to learn. We will not accept al-Qaeda or al-Nusra. And he had to Inskeep pursued it. It's disgusting, but that defines him completely. His the way he reports. So it's really obviously the Saudis would be do everything they possibly could to sabotage this, and Israel now has a new policy which has not been reported. That any shell, any mortar, any shell that comes across the border into the Golan Heights, which they illegally occupy, shot from anybody, the Israelis will retaliate and are retaliating against a Syrian military encampment, a military target.
So
if anything is going to break this deal in Syria, it's not going to be the Russians. It's going to be our allies.
This is true.
You've been covering issues on the Middle East for a long time. You have seen this destabilization is going on. In the last couple of minutes, do you see any prospect for or is it going to get worse after November?
Well, the outlook is not hopeful. Clinton, I mean, who knows really what, I mean, Donald, you know, sometimes one can seize on things that Donald Trump has said, you know, about, you know, we shouldn't be interventionist and, you know, we shouldn't be, what are we doing fighting in Syria and, you know, engaging in the Syrian war and everything. But the trouble is with Donald Trump, he has the, you know, he has the attention span of a gnat. He, you know, he's a completely unknown quantity, and I really wouldn't put any faith on him doing the right thing. And on the other side, you have Clinton, who, you know, has said very definitely and repeatedly that she wants a no-fly zone. I mean, basically wants, you know, wants confrontation with Russia in Syria. I mean, she's surrounded by this, you know, disgusting claque of neocons, who seem to have, you know, learned nothing and forgotten everything. So the outlook is not hopeful. I mean, God help us. I think we're going to be nostalgic for Obama.
Well, that would take some nostalgia, because he certainly has. I would give him the hypocrite of the year award of the last decade award for his statements and then his actions.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He's under his administration. The United States has sold more arms to foreign countries than any president before him.
This is true, yeah. It's a major, you know, they had an overall policy of increasing exports, and arms were a very important component of that. And when they made this, you know, Saudi deal in 2010, if you look at the Hillary Clinton emails, they're all busily congratulating each other and saying, what a Christmas present and good news and, you know, all that.
Andrew Coburn, I want to thank you again. I want to tell listeners online, I believe you'll be able to find.
Yes.
You will be able to find, because I found it there. Andrew Coburn, his latest article is called Acceptable Losses, Aiding and Abetting the Saudi Slaughter in Yemen. And what it's a bit of a masochist to read this, but you have to realize this is America's responsibility, and we have to do something about it. And I want to thank you very much for doing something about it, Andrew, and be our guest today on Takes on the World.
Hey, you're welcome. It's great to be with you.
Yes,
thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And this is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.